The Blood Angels Space Marines are the noble and courageous scions of the Primarch Sanguinius, who was known as the Great Angel, the Brightest One, the Master of Hosts, and many other titles and honorifics. In armor of rich gold, bold crimson, and mournful black, do they descend from on high into glorious battle. There do they smite the foes of the Imperium, purging the unclean, scouring the heretic, and liberating the faithful. In Sanguinius's perfect image, the malnourished sons of a ruined system are sculpted as an artist molds the great heroes of myth. They emerge from their apotheosis as mighty warriors, beautiful in form, elegance and bearing. The stunted grow tall, the feeble grow strong, the sickly grow hale. Thus is the great angel's vision for the Imperium embodied in his own sons. No matter the wretchedness of humanity's existence, it has potential to rise anew, more wonderful than mankind itself could ever imagine. For 10,000 years it has been so, but the price the Blood Angels have paid for their loyalty is hideous. Sanguinius was slain by the arch-traitor Horus, and the spiritual shock of his death would bedevil his gene sons forevermore. Few know the true cost of the Great Angel's demise, though it is one the Blood Angels pay to this day. The toll of what is known as the flaw growing greater with each passing year. Heritage of Sanguinius. The Blood Angels are the scions of the Primarch Sanguinius, one of the greatest of all the Primarchs. He sculpted and fashioned the Blood Angels as he saw fit. Inheritors of his genetic legacy, his sons have formidable combat skills and a deep philosophy, continuously striving to live up to his example. It was upon Baal Secundus, the second moon of the planet Baal, that Sanguinius was discovered during the Great Crusade. It is believed that Baal Secundus was once a verdant paradise, its peoples highly advanced, but by the time of Sanguinius's discovery, it was an irradiated hellscape, and has remained that way into the 41st millennium. The people of Baal were badly affected by their harsh environment, universally malnourished, sickly, feeble, and afflicted by lesions, blemishes, and carcinomas. They remain so to this day, scratching a living from the husks of their once great civilization, and only braving the elements in patched rad suits. Sanguinius, immune to the ravages of his adoptive world, was a vision of impeccable beauty, who united his people, bringing a hope they had never had before. Once rediscovered by the Imperium and united with his legion, his burning desire to improve the lot of those around him extended not only to the Space Marines he inherited, but also to humanity itself, and he imbued his sons with his vision for the betterment of mankind. To join the Blood Angels, aspirants must reach the place of challenge at Angel's Fall, where Sanguinius is said to have arrived on Bal Secundus 10,000 years ago. The journey across rad-soaked deserts is fraught with peril, with many dying due to harsh elements or dangerous predators, such as fire scorpions, catch spiders, and thirst water. Those who survive this perilous journey must then pass through a number of winnowings, in which the chapter determines who is worthy of progression. More perish in these deadly games and tournaments, but the successful aspirants are taken to the Arx Angelicum, the Blood Angels' fortress monastery upon Bal itself. There, without rest, they must observe a candlelit vigil for 3 days and 3 nights in the great chapel of the Blood Angel. Those who fail are never seen again. Soon after, the sanguinary priests provide the aspirants who remain with the sanguinary chalice, from which they sup a small amount of blood drawn from the priest's veins, which themselves carry the blood of the Primarch. This process, called ensanguination, leads them to fall into a deep slumber. Hooded blood servitors chant the Credo Vitae as they carry the aspirants to the Hall of the Sarcophagi, an immense gilded cathedral where they are enclosed for a year in huge golden caskets. In this time, they are intravenously fed with nutrients and more of Sanguinius's blood, and receive the implants they need to become Space Marines. More die in this process, or wake up too soon. Throughout their sleep, the aspirants have dreams of moments from their Primarch's life, the details of which are permanently etched into their souls. Their year complete, they emerge as full Space Marines. Strong, tough, and tall, these warriors possess a natural grace, bravery, puissant skill, and nobility akin to that of Sanguinius. They become long-lived, and with such time do they set their minds to varied pursuits and disciplines, many training to become blade masters or sublimely skilled artisans. Blood angels are formed in a master sculptor's ideal of beauty, with smooth skin and elegant features. They adorn their weapons, armor, and vehicles, and banners, with beautiful art and fine embellishments, emblazoning them with all manner of chapter icons, including droplets of blood, angels' wings, and chalices. No effort, time, or expense is spared in acquiring the finest resources for such craft. Bloodstone is carefully extracted by hand from the deep caves of the Kroar Mountains on Bal, while the white pigment used to paint angels' wings can only be obtained by crushing the shells of bloodthirsty sand clams. The Blood Angels have even fought wars to claim the precious metals they use for decoration, or to attain the spine worm larvae that produce the taffeta used to make standards and ceremonial tabards. These Space Marines are as diligent in the making of their war gear and maintaining of their heirlooms as they are in defending the Imperium, and few chapters have a battle record as impeccable as theirs. For all their wondrous beauty, the elegance of their artisanship, and their magnificence on the battlefield, all of which can be credited to Sanguinius, There is a haunting dark side to the legacy the Blood Angels have inherited. And it is for this reason that so many pursue their disciplines to such degree. For many, becoming the perfect swordsman or fashioning the perfect axe is but a means to focus their mind and control their inner fury. Exemplars of the Host. Though the Blood Angels and their successors are haunted by the death of Sanguinius, they nonetheless embody the great virtues of their angelic Primarch, and they seek to emulate his example wherever and whenever they can. Some brothers achieve this to a greater standard than others. The Sanguinary Guard trace their heritage back to the Great Crusade, when they served as bodyguards to Sanguinius himself. Since that time, every Blood Angel's successor chapter has had a formation of these warriors, as directed by Ascalon, the leader of their noble order at the time of the Legion's dissolution. As the Sanguinary Guard are ancient, so too is their war gear. They can trace the lineage of their golden armor and wrist-mounted Angulus bolt guns to the time of the Horus Heresy. It is no different for the mighty Incarmine glaives they wield, which cannot be scratched, warped, or broken, no matter how terrible the violence wrought by or against them. Made of angel steel, the secrets of the forging of these beautiful and deadly swords and axes are known only to the Blood Angels' artificers. A Sanguinary Guard's most iconic item of war gear is their death mask. The stern-faced visages of those golden war helms crackle with halos of light, giving the masks a terrifying aura that panics the foe and can even put them to flight. The machine spirit within each mask forms a bond of unbreakable loyalty with the wearer. And should the Sanguinary Guard fall in battle, his mask is placed in the Sarcophagus of Sorrows on Baal for 7 days and nights, in which time the mask takes on the stylized features of its former wearer. Together, the Sanguinary Guard's war gear is a reminder of the chapter and the Imperium's great history. The deeds of each Sanguinary Guard are recorded with great assiduousness and recited during sacred rites, chapter celebrations, and on feast days. They speak of Uzrael, who swept Ansel III's skies of winged Drukhari warriors in a night and a day, and Vesta, who purged the leaders of the Cult of the Bloody Eyes from Vladzik Prime with flame and axe. Accounts are read of Mataneo, who slew the bodyguard of the Necron overlord Anok the Gilded before beheading the megalomaniac Xenos leader, and countless more tales of glory that ensure that every brother who ascends to the ranks of the Sanguinary Guard knows he's joining a valorous brotherhood with a most glorious legacy. The secrets of Sanguinius's blood are central to the traditions of the chapter. It is the responsibility of the Sanguinary Priests to guard them, in addition to being fully trained apothecaries. Sanguinary Priests begin their training serving as sanguinary novitiates, mastering the use of the Narthecium and Reductor to heal their brother's injuries. Only once they excel in these skills are they fully inducted into the sanguinary priesthood. To join this order, the novitiate must drink the blood of the assembled sanguinary priests from the Red Grail. The sanguinary priests have always played a crucial role in the Blood Angels' recruitment, and it is in this role that their knowledge of the Primarch's blood comes into play. It is thought that during the Great Crusade and Horus Heresy, the Legion's aspirants imbibed samples of Sanguinius's blood in a process called ensanguination. After the Primarch's tragic fall, the sanguinary priests retained the last drops of Sanguinius's blood in the Red Grail. They then injected what remained of this most precious resource into their bodies to preserve it, making them its living hosts. To this day, this blood flows in the veins of the sanguinary priests, as each has supped from the Red Grail upon their ascension to this brotherhood. And it is this that is given to the chapter's new recruits. It is also the sanguinary priest's sacred duty to carry the blood chalices, the first of which was given to the priesthood by Sanguinius himself. Many of these artifacts have been destroyed over the millennia, their surviving shards incorporated into new chalices or into the priest's Narthecium's. Some believe a part of Sanguinius's essence was somehow woven into the chalices' form, allowing nearby blood angels to hear their Primarch's voice. Whilst none can truly verify this, the effect these artifacts have on the Space Marines is nonetheless astounding, filling them with furious vigor. In battle, sanguinary priests encourage the Blood Angels to control their raging bloodlust and to unleash it against the enemy in times of dire need. In the heat of battle, nearby Blood Angels are affected by the Red Grail, as they are with blood chalices, but to an even greater degree. As sanguinary high priest of the Blood Angels, Corbulo is the keeper of the Red Grail. His position has meant that Corbulo has spent centuries seeking a cure for the flaw. In his attempts to neutralize the weakness in his chapter's gene seed, he has traveled to the apothecarians of other chapters and walked upon abandoned worlds, attempting to find lost archaeotech that might aid his cause. Corbulo is considered by many to resemble Sanguinius in look and character more than any living blood angel. And the gift of foresight Corbulo possesses supports this view. Corbulo is a warrior of deep wisdom and invaluable insight, traits further enhanced by his intense study of the scrolls of Sanguinius. In these sacred texts, he seeks to combine the knowledge he has acquired from his own visions with those Sanguinius recorded millennia ago, and in doing so, forewarn his chapter of dangers to come. Without his efforts, the Blood Angels would have had far less warning of High Fleet Leviathan's attack. The flaw The Blood Angels are a dying chapter, afflicted by the dreadful curse known as the Flaw, the Blood Angels' greatest secret. It is a twin threat, with every Blood Angel vulnerable to the afflictions known as the Red Thirst and the Black Rage. The former clouds the minds of the afflicted with a feverish blood madness, but it is at least temporary. The Black Rage is permanent. The sufferer's sanity is destroyed and their soul lost forever to a crazed, uncontrollable fury. Over the millennia, more and more Blood Angels have been clutched in the grip of the Flaw. Deep within the psyche of every son of Sanguinius is a destructive yearning, a blood hunger that haunts their every waking moment and aches to be unleashed without restraint, but must be held at bay. This is the Red Thirst, and despite their every effort, the Blood Angels commonly yield to it in the heat of battle. To succumb to it is a mark of shame in any but the most dire of circumstances, where victory can only be achieved with ferocious savagery. On occasion, the Blood Angels choose to unleash it as a weapon under the careful guidance of the sanguinary priests, and only then as a last resort. It is not unknown for the inhabitants of worlds on which the Blood Angels are fighting to be discovered drained of blood. This may be the work of cultists seeking to disparage the chapter, or of superstitious populations making sacrifices to their angelic saviors. It is also possible, however, that the blood of these citizens was indeed consumed by Blood Angels in thrall to the Red Thirst. The Blood Angels have a uniquely strong bond and blood link with their Primarch. Sanguinius's experiences are encoded into their gene seed, and no memory is more powerful than that of his last titanic duel with the arch-traitor Horus. During this fight, the Blood Angel's gene sire was struck so dolorous a blow that it wounded his very soul, and has resounded through the spirits of his scions even unto the 41st millennium. To the ignorant, a warrior in the grip of the Black Rage is simply consumed by irrepressible anger, half mad with fury. In reality, he no longer has any awareness of who or where he is, either believing himself to be Sanguinius in his final hours, or to be fighting in one of the horrific battles of the Horus Heresy. Brothers consumed in such a way are inducted into the Death Company, the ranks within which they will fight one final battle in their Primarch's name. The Blood Angels have learned much of how the Black Rage afflicts the suffering Battle Brothers by using the Lestrilio procedure, named for the tragic chaplain who pioneered the process and was later subject to it. Those who have succumbed to the Black Rage, yet have no enemy upon which to unleash their fury, are shackled in adamantine and encouraged to talk of what they see. What rantings and ravings the Space Marine can utter are carefully recorded, analyzed, and compared with others. This procedure inevitably kills the warrior in body-shattering spasms, but collated results have given the Blood Angels invaluable data on what the Black Rage is and how it affects the sufferer. Exactly why the flaw exists is intensely debated amongst the Blood Angels, their successor chapters, and those elements of the Imperial hierarchy that have somehow learned of it. Some suggest the flaw is rooted in chaos corruption. They claim it was the Dark Gods who contrived to steal Sanguinius from the Emperor and leave him on Baal Secundus, and that the Primarch was deeply affected by their touch. His wings evidence of this. Most dismiss this claim, citing Sanguinius's unfailing loyalty to the Emperor, as well as that of his sons ever since. Others claim that the process of ensanguination has contributed to the flaw's manifestation. Supporters of this theory contest that not only would any inherent corruption in Sanguinius be passed on more directly to his sons, but that over 10,000 years the cells would no doubt have mutated. Whilst this may have happened slowly at first, accrued errors would significantly increase in number over time. It is well known to the sanguinary priests and those adepts of Mars who have studied the Blood Angel's gene seed that the scions of Sanguinius have an overactive omophagy, an organ that allows space marines to absorb the skills and memories of the dead by consuming their flesh. Though theories abound as to why this is the case, none know with any assuredness. It is entirely possible that this fault in their gene seed has led the Blood Angels and their successors to develop blood-drinking and even flesh-eating rituals in the past, though many of these practices are far more prevalent in some chapters than others. The process of absorption has narcotic qualities, and it is possible that the sons of Sanguinius feel this effect more strongly than most. Other theories discuss the impact Baal Secundus's strange cocktails of chemical toxins and radiation might have had on the Blood Angels. The Baalite scriptures, stored deep within the chapter's librarium, record that this moon was once inhabited by all manner of mutant tribes, against which Sanguinius and his people waged war. If Baal Secundus's population could affect much of its human population in such a grotesque way, it is not beyond imagination that gene seed might also be altered. These ideas are dismissed by most Blood Angels, citing Sanguinius's immunity to the ravages of the radiation-scarred moon, as well as the transition each member of their brotherhood goes through in the golden sarcophagus, purging them of the frailties bestowed by their home world. It is possible that all of these factors play a role, their impact varying on an individual basis, thus explaining why there is no way of predicting when a son of Sanguinius might succumb to either of the flaw's terrible aspects. Some of the Blood Angel's successor chapters have been more gravely afflicted than others. A number are accused of failing to take the correct precautions and allowing themselves to surrender to the grip of the Red Thirst too easily. Others were founded in more recent centuries, by which time the Blood Angel's gene seed may have already degraded considerably. Factors such as the environment of their homeworlds and those they have campaigned on or their proximity to warp storms have all been suggested. For some chapters, the flaw has overwhelmed them completely, leading to them being declared excommunicate traitors, or being intentionally dispatched to unwinnable wars where every one of their number is wiped out, having fought as frothing lunatics against impossible odds. The flaw does offer some advantages. Being so aware of their own failings has made the Blood Angels better able to appreciate the weaknesses of others, rendering them far more sympathetic to humanity than many other chapters. The Blood Angels are well known for racing to the aid of Imperial citizenry, even when there is no obvious strategic gain in doing so, and work in close concert with non-Space Marine forces, such as the Adepta Sororitas and Astra Militarum. The Blood Angels, nonetheless, make every effort to resist the call of the Red Thirst, and are desperate in their desire to be free of the Black Rage. They take up strict disciplines, whether this be in art, bladesmanship, poetry, calligraphy, or weapon forging, to focus their minds. They spend as much time as possible on those rare occasions when they are not at war sleeping in the sarcophagi used to create them, within which the sanguinary priests have developed filters to cleanse and purify the Space Marine's blood, in hopes that the degeneracy of the flaw may be slowed. It was hoped by some that the arrival of the Primaris Space Marines might prove to be their salvation from the flaw. This hope was a false one, as many of this new breed across the Blood Angels and their successor chapters have already been inducted into the Death Company. The Death Company. Any scion of Sanguinius can be struck down by the Black Rage. This spiritual curse dwells deep within the soul of every Blood Angel, and there is little telling as to when it might take hold of its victim. Those that are consumed by it are folded into the Death Company, a fearsome and morbid brotherhood of madmen. On the eve of battle, the Blood Angels bend the knee and turn their thoughts to Sanguinius's sacrifice. Chaplains pace amongst the warriors, blessing each while chanting the Mor Patris, the Mass of Doom. They take careful note of which warriors slur their speech, are glazed of eye, or appear overly excitable, for these are most likely to succumb to the Black Rage. Most do not, as much of their training has been dedicated to suppressing the strength of this affliction. For some, however, its call is too strong, and the memories of their Primarch too overwhelming. These warriors collapse into the chaplain's arms and are inducted into the Death Company. In their minds, the Death Company have lost all knowledge of who they are, where they are, and even the time in which they are living. Their consciousnesses are thrust millennia into the past, where they believe they are fighting in the cataclysmic battles of the Horus Heresy. Whether it be on the walls of the Imperial Palace, on one of the myriad forgotten battlefields, in which the Blood Angels undoubtedly fought, or within the twisted and warped corridors of Horus's corrupted flagship, the Vengeful Spirit. Many believe they are Sanguinius himself, engaged in combat with the arch-traitor. Though in reality, they may be fighting lithe Tyranid horrors or hulking orc brutes. In their minds, they are striking down heretic Astartes. Regardless, they are lost to their brothers and chapter forever, swept up by an unbreakable madness. Though most of the time, few brothers fall into the appalling embrace of the Black Rage, and on occasion, none do at all, it has not been unheard of for entire strike forces to yield to it. These terrible moments are marks of shame in the Blood Angels' history, and names such as Nykoth, the Skadden Atrocity, the War of Broken Wings, the Stenar Massacre, and the Battle of Linicky Reach conjure a mournful silence in any gathering of Sanguinius's gene sons. The Blood Angels believe that giving these warriors of the Death Company the most glorious possible death is a responsibility of paramount importance. If they are going to spend the lives of their brothers, it must come at greatest cost to the enemy. In their view, the Death Company were once heroic defenders of humanity, and thus have earned a noble end. With great sadness, the Death Company's armor is painted in the black of mourning and is adorned with crimson psalteries to represent Sanguinius's sacrifice. Parchments are hung from their plate, detailing the warriors' battles and victories. Thus are their great deeds in life commemorated and their worth affirmed. The Death Company are sent into fights no sane warrior would engage in, and they win. They hack monstrous beasts to death, smash through impenetrable lines that have resisted Imperial assault for months, and lead savage boarding actions against enemy capital ships, flooding narrow corridors with the foe's blood. In great sieges that have lasted for years, they serve as the forlorn hope, crashing over battlements to sweep them clear of enemies, to snatch victory after victory from the jaws of defeat. On Truitas, Antax, Holonon, Armageddon, and countless other worlds over the centuries. In their fury, the Death Company demonstrate frightening strength and incredible resilience. Some believe that in their madness, these battle brothers possess a portion of Sanguinius's power, though in the view of many more of these traits are simply the products of their unrelenting insanity. Regardless, Death Company warriors fight on through the most brutal of circumstances, from losing limbs to having their chests blown out or even being set alight, all the while their eyes remain filled with frantic killing light, and terrifying roars pour forth from their vox grills. The onerous duty of guiding the enraged Death Company into the hell of war falls to the chaplains. Their bellicose oaths and zealous commitment exhorting their deranged brothers to even greater acts of violence. Nonetheless, particularly strong-willed scions of Sanguinius, such as members of the Sanguinary Guard, have been known to lead the Death Company, despite not belonging to the Reclusium. Lucian Galani of the Blood Drinkers Sanguinary Guard insisted on painting one of his shoulder guards black in their honor, after seeing their sacrifice and accomplishments firsthand during the war for Malachian's Hope. It is an unfortunate reality for the Sons of Sanguinius that, on occasion, not every member of the Death Company will fall in battle. Most will die in the aftermath, finally slain by their horrendous wounds, or by a merciful axe blow from the Redeemer of the Lost, whose solemn duty is to end their suffering. For those who cannot be released from their curse in these ways, the Red Thirst almost always awaits them. Their berserk fury somehow made worse by an insatiable thirst for blood and hunger for flesh. These unfortunate souls are locked away deep within the Tower of Amarillo on Baal, for their own safety as well as that of their brothers. Howls echo throughout the tower, and those who hear these screams are filled with pity, hoping that when their own time comes, they will meet death in battle rather than suffer such an ignoble fate. Ashtoreth the Grim. There is no rank within the Blood Angels more honored or loathed than Redeemer of the Lost. It is held in highest esteem for the terrible burden its bearer must carry, and the harsh duties they must enact. It is reviled because the Redeemer has the blood of countless brothers on his hands, a stain that can never be removed. Ashtoreth the Grim seeks out those souls so gripped by the black rage that not even death in battle is possible for them. To those individuals, he brings swift mercy, beheading them with a single stroke of the weapon of his office, the executioner's axe. Any scion of Sanguinius feels deeply unsettled around Ashtoreth. The weight of his terrible burden and the ceaseless grief he endures have given him a humorless, dour manner, and every battle brother knows that one day it might be them who is brought to an end by the lethal weapon he carries. Long ago, the Jean Sons of Sanguinius agreed that the burdens of the Redeemer of the Lost were so terrible they should fall on the shoulders of a single brother. Since his ascension to the post, Ashtoreth alone has been equal to this task, though in recent years it has grown ever more arduous. He has spent longer and longer away from Baal, crossing the stars in pursuit of the soul call of the Black Rage wherever he hears it, journeying amongst the Blood Angel's successors aboard his ship, the Imminent Sanguis, which has been used by his predecessors for millennia. To many, it appears that Ashtoreth actually encourages the Black Rage to emerge amongst those with whom he walks. This is false. Only he can hear the doom-laden chords of the Black Rage's call, the forlorn symphony of which cannot be silenced or even dulled, even with great distance. Only he can detect the emergent flaw in a soul before any other, and will stop at nothing to reach such afflicted battle brothers, hacking apart all who stand in his way. And so Ashtoreth is as true an angel of death as any, both to his rivals and battle brothers. Wherever he fights, warriors of the Death Company are by his side, their combined power a terrible onslaught that devastates any enemy they reach. Ashtoreth channels his deep sorrow into a ferocious battle fury, and hews apart foe after foe in his savage determination to give his doomed brothers the glorious end in battle each deserves after their years in service. Lamardes. Few knew the graceful nuances and sublime edicts of the cult Sanguinius, the doctrines and beliefs of the Blood Angels and their successors better than Chaplain Lamardes. He was deeply learned in the rites of initiation, vindication, and redemption, the Blood Pact, the Host Throng, the Nine Incarmine Axioms, and the Orders of the Circulus Innate Angelus. For all his unfathomable wisdom and the admiration of his brothers, he was no less vulnerable to the Black Rage. Chaplain Lamardes fell to the Black Rage during the liberation of Hadriath 11. Unlike the other warriors of the Death Company who spearheaded the planet strike, Lamardes survived and carved a bloody path through the Orc defenders, finally collapsing from his wounds only when the battle was won. Then he was brought to the field apothecarium inside the now-captured fortress to await the arrival of Astaroth, Redeemer of the Lost. Yet, when Astaroth arrived to deliver the chaplain into death's embrace, Lamardes demanded to live. Such a thing was unheard of. Though his eyes were bloodshot and his muscles taut with fury, Lamardes' words were clear and cognate. Whilst members of the Death Company were often so deranged that Astaroth had to best them in combat before he could take their lives, never before had one challenged him in so lucid a fashion. Quashing all dissent, Astaroth ordered that the chaplain be placed in stasis and returned to Baal until the chapter's librarians and sanguinary priests could make a full examination of him. This investigation took several months, during which time Lamardes was largely kept in stasis to ensure the safety of those around him. But the results seemed to reinforce Astaroth's hopes. The chaplain was unquestionably in the grip of the Black Rage, for all the physical signs were there. Yet his mind was not riven with insanity. Through an act of incredible willpower, Lamardes appeared able to hold his madness in check. Several sanguinary priests argued that this was but a temporary respite, but Astaroth was not so sure. Refusing to slay Lamardes, as many wished, he awoke the chaplain from his enforced slumber and offered him a way in which he could continue to serve. So did Lamardes become the guardian of the lost and the wielder of the ancient blood Crozius. He has repaid Astaroth's faith 1,000 times over, for the Death Company have never been so potent a force as they are under his guidance. At battle's end, he is placed in stasis once more. The slumber through the weeks and months until his bloody talents are required again. For Lamardes, there is no longer any calm before the storm. His life is one constant battle, for he is awoken when needed and preserved when he is not. Lamardes is surely living on borrowed time, for even his formidable willpower cannot keep the Black Rage at bay indefinitely. Yet for the moment at least, the chaplain's iron will holds firm. He is a symbol of hope to a chapter slipping into darkness. For if Lamardis can continue to reason and serve his chapter within the dark insanity of the Black Rage, perhaps others can do so too. Ordering the Host. Legend tells that it was Ascalon of the Sanguinary Guard who made the historic decision to break up the Blood Angels to form chapters in accordance with the Codex Astartes, making his legion amongst the first to do so. Even then, the flaw was making its mark upon Sanguinius' sons, and the Blood Angels could ill afford organizational disputes at such a trying time as this. Largely a codex-adherent chapter, the Blood Angels organization has small differences that accommodate the flaw and allow for traditional idiosyncrasies. To them, the Codex is not only a source of military wisdom, but also great discipline that can further aid them in restraining their dark urges. The Blood Angels are led by their chapter master and the chapter council, made up of company captains, chaplains, sanguinary priests, the Logidicium, fleet captains, and others. This body oversees the entire chapter and the ball system, as well as managing the Blood Angels' much expanded duties in being one of the principal imperial authorities in the Imperium Nihilus. Many of the Blood Angels' officers hold additional titles, offices, and functions. Some of these are drawn from the Codex, such as the Master of the Marches or Master of the Watch. Others have evolved according to the Blood Angels' needs and deep traditions over time, such as the Shield of Baal, Lord of Skyfall, and Caller of the Fires. Sanguinius himself developed the Sanguinary Priesthood and placed his legion's apothecarian on an organizational par with the chaplaincy. It is believed that he foresaw the troubles his son would face in the future, and thus made these changes, both apothecarian and reclusium, were to have equal part in the legion's, and later the chapter's, spiritual guidance. A council of sanguinary priests and chaplains, known as the Council of Bone and Blood, appoints a new chapter master should one be required. During the rigorous vetting process, whereby potential candidates are assessed for their will and worthiness, the sanguinary high priest and high chaplain take joint temporary rule. The potent force of spiritual might flows through the Blood Angels' veins, one of many gifts these battle brothers possess thanks to the power of their Primarch. They are also numbered amongst the most psychically gifted chapters, and their large quantity of librarians reflects this. Demands on the Blood Angels' logistical skills have never been higher. Thousands of space marines from their successor chapters are fighting in the Red Scar, all in need of armaments. In the aftermath of the Tyranid siege, the emergence of the Great Rift, and Dante's naming as regent and warden of the Imperium Nihilus, the Blood Angels' homeworld has become a hub of activity for all manner of Imperial personnel, and a growing administration has been developed to support it. Commander Dante. Commander Dante rules the Blood Angels. He is the bringer of Sanguinius's light, hero of the Red Scar, uniter of the Sanguinary Brotherhood, and the living embodiment of the five angelic graces. He is among the oldest living Space Marines and is the longest serving Chapter Master. To describe him as a legend is an understatement bordering on insult. None can deny the scope of Dante's campaign experience. He has fought battles uncounted, orchestrated innumerable campaigns, and seized bloody victories on worlds as far-flung as Orc-Riven Vordrast and the rebellious Formund. It is said that no man has visited as many of the Imperium's million worlds as Dante. To his fellow chapter masters, Dante is an exemplar of the fearlessness, dedication, and strategic genius at the heart of the Space Marines' never-ending mission. To the hard-pressed generals and marshals of the Imperial Guard, he is a thrice-welcomed ally at the forefront of mankind's defense. To the common soldiers and citizens of the Imperium, Dante is nothing less than a savior, a golden god who descends from the heavens on wings of fire. So long now has Dante lived that his exploits have passed gradually into myth. Did Dante truly banish the Keeper of Secrets, J. Fahulian, the Pulchritudinous, before the hanging pleasure gardens of fabled Luxurusa? Did he really face an entire Black Legion warband alone, rescuing the pilgrims aboard the Toils of the Faithful from a truly hideous end? How many did he save in relieving the siege of Maculos? How many heretics did Dante cleave in two during the emancipation of Parvolos? Only Dante himself can say with certainty. Yet he speaks not on such events. The Imperium needs heroes, needs hope in these dark times, and the commander of the Blood Angels does his part to prevent mankind from losing heart. He has become his mask for the sake of the Imperium, rarely removing it in the knowledge that, should those who adore him see his tired features and long white hair, he may no longer be regarded as the glorious champion they believe in and so desperately require. Yet, for all his success, or perhaps because of it, Dante has grown weary of his labors. The burden of centuries grows ever weightier. Only one thing prevents him succumbing to ennui. Recorded in the scrolls of Sanguinius are the Primarch's visions of a great battle to overshadow all others, where one golden warrior will stand between his emperor and the darkness. For many generations of the Blood Angels, these prophecies were read as Sanguinius's foreknowledge of his own fate. Yet through some instinct, possibly a lingering trace of his Primarch's fabled far-seeing eye, Dante believes otherwise. He has always known that a defense of the Emperor will one day rest in his hands, and that he will have to be ready for that greatest of duties. The Lord of the Blood Angel suspects that time may now have finally come. Dante has been made regent and warden of the Imperium Nihilus by none other than Rebute Gilliman himself. The scale of such responsibility is impossible to fathom. This half of the Imperium drowns in darkness. Communications are nigh impossible, and travel is extremely hazardous. Each passing day, the exhausted astropaths of the Red Scar are battered with hundreds of harrowing pleas for aid from worlds in the grip of terrifying Drakari raids, invaded by rampaging warbands of heretic Astartes, or on the edge of consumption by the warp itself. All the while, much of the Red Scar is plagued by surviving tendrils of Hive Fleet Leviathan, which ravaged the region prior to the Great Rift's emergence. Being named Lord of Half the Galaxy by a figure as eminent as Gilliman should be a great gift, but in reality, it is a terrible burden. Each day, billions die, and worlds are lost, Dante and his blood angels unable to help. Nonetheless, Dante strives to live up to his responsibilities. Already, he has launched his counterattacks throughout the Red Scar, seizing strategically vital worlds and rescuing beleaguered populations. He has dispatched fleets further afield to serve as his heralds, to bring hope to the despairing masses. His message is to stand firm, that the Warden and Regent fights with them in spirit and battles daily to reach them. Though beset on all sides by myriad threats from the traitor, alien, and heretic, with countless wars raging throughout the Red Scar and beyond, Baal is in the process of an enormous transformation. The Blood Angel's homeworld is becoming a beacon for refugees and a mustering point for scattered Imperial forces. Dante has ordered the massive expansion of Skyfall, the Blood Angel's enormous space dock, to enable it to serve as a fleet support base for a vast armada of warships, formed of those vessels Dante has been able to summon to Baal, and those that have fled here. Dante believes that this fleet Nihilus can be the beginning of a reclamation force that restores Imperial rule to the domain placed in his charge. Mephiston. Dark, brooding, and enormously powerful, Mephiston is the Blood Angel's chief librarian. A figure of awe in the chapter, many sons of Sanguinius perceive him as a savior, not only because of his power, but because of what he has overcome. Mephiston is the only known Blood Angel to have wholly cast out the Black Rage. Mephiston was once Calistarius, a promising librarian. It was during the Second War for Armageddon that he fell to the Black Rage. One more example of the terrible waste of life begotten by the Flaw. During the fighting, tons of masonry fell upon Calistarius and trapped him for days. He was tormented by visions, teetering on the brink between life and death, sanity and madness, but he did not succumb. Through incredible strength of will, he confronted the Black Rage that stained his soul and rejected it. Upon this miraculous achievement, he burst free from the ruins that trapped him, reborn as Mephiston, Lord of Death. Through means that remain a mystery to the sanguinary priests and the librarians, Mephiston's gene seed had somehow been awoken by his traumatic experience, imbuing him with abilities beyond those the greatest of his battle brothers. The Lord of Death could move at speeds almost too fast for the eye to follow. And such was his strength that he could pulverize Ceramite with his bare hands. Mephiston rose rapidly through the Librarium's ranks to become chief librarian. He is now an icon of hope to his brothers, for if he can defeat the Black Rage, perhaps others can too. Some Blood Angels are less convinced, wondering what terrible price the Lord of Death may have had to pay for his so-called victory. After the Great Rift tore the galaxy in two, Mephiston only grew more powerful. To those suspicious of him, this only made him more dangerous. His detractors' concerns appeared to be validated when fighting aboard the battleship Dominance against Slaaneshi demons. Mephiston's powers overwhelmed him. For this, he was locked within the Kimmich spheres, a prison deep within the Arx Angelicum. It was during this incarceration that librarian Gaius Rocallus suggested Mephiston cross the Rubicon Primaris to help him contain his powers. It was a risk. Many feared it might make Mephiston even more dangerous. But he underwent the days-long and agonizing operation and survived, emerging not only more powerful, but also more stable. No Blood Angels, however, know what Mephiston truly went through, or what terrible truths he learned, and the horrifying visions he experienced, all of which he has vowed to never reveal. Captain Tycho. Brother Captain Erasmus Tycho was once the greatest strike leader the Blood Angels have ever known. Rumored to be Dante's protege and chosen successor, now his memory stands as a grim reminder that even the chapter's brightest and best are not safe from the clutches of the Black Rage. Even before Tycho ascended the Blood Angels' ranks, to many, he was a paragon of the five angelic graces: honor, humility, mercy, restraint, and forgiveness. Tycho took command of the Blood Angels' third company when his predecessor was slain during the Second War for Armageddon. The former sergeant swiftly proved his mettle, orchestrating the rout of Boss Gracca's speed freaks and recapturing key defensive positions along the River Chernin. Heartened by their successes, the Third Company pushed on, striking at Orc supply lines from Armageddon Prime. It was on such a mission that Tycho and his company were ambushed. Though the Blood Angels triumphed, their captain fell victim to an Orc Weird Boy's psychic assault early in the battle, and was left for dead. Through luck, or sheer belligerence, Tycho survived, but the terrible psychic onslaught had paralyzed half of his face, freezing it forever in a rictus grin. Tycho's obsession with fine aesthetic taste and beauty was as great as that of any other Blood Angel, and to him, such a fate was worse than death itself. So it was that bitterness and rage began to creep into Tycho's once pure heart, opening the door to the pent-up anger that lay at the core of Tycho's very being. Unable to bear the pitiful looks of his battle brothers, Tycho ordered the chapter's most revered artificer to forge him a mask to cover his disfigurement. This simple act seemed to grant Tycho a measure of peace, and for a time he regained his old composure. For the remainder of the Armageddon campaign, the Blood Angels' third company stood in the thick of the fighting. Tycho directed their efforts as he had in the early stages, though none could deny that an increased fervor stole over the captain whenever he tasted the tang of orc blood upon the air. More and more, he embraced the five warriors' virtues: strength, savagery, abandon, rage, and detachment. In the wake of that great campaign, it swiftly became apparent that not all was right with Tycho. No longer could he be relaxed in the hallowed halls of the chapter fortress, for its beauty served only to remind him of his own mutation. Dante reluctantly assigned Tycho to permanent battle duty, where he became ever more violent of temperament and attitude. His tactics audacious to the point of foolhardiness. Finally, when Gaskell returned to Armageddon and Tycho revisited the war that had seen him mutilated so many years before, his mind snapped. Lost in the depths of rage, the captain took his place in the Death Company, at the head of a mass of raving, delusional battle brothers. Tycho led the assault upon the breach at Hive Tempestora. Though his charge carried the day, and the ferocity of assault has since become legend, the captain fell at last, on the planet where perhaps he should have perished long before. Flesh Terrors. Few chapters have a reputation for savagery like the Flesh Terrors. Violence made manifest, to fight them in battle is to face a storm of whirling chain blades wielded by howling warriors bent on inflicting total slaughter. Blighted by tragedy, the Flesh Terrors' bloodthirst has defined them, and few of the Scions of Sanguinius are as afflicted by the flaw as they. The Flesh Terrors were formed upon the dissolution of the Blood Angels Legion as a part of the Second Founding. Initially existing as a crusading force, they swept the stars clean of those traitors that remained, slaughtering the foes of mankind without mercy. Rumors of their savagery abounded, and collateral damage inflicted by their wars was shocking even by the harsh standards of the Imperium. But the galaxy is an immense place, and in the aftermath of the Horus Heresy, Imperial Command lacked the time, resources, and inclination to investigate further. To those who received reports of such atrocities, if traitors were being purged, it was only for the better. It is believed that it was only after many years that the Flesh Terrors settled on Cretacea, the planet that was to become their home world. The fourth in a system of seven worlds, Cretacea is shrouded in dense cloud and racked by volatile electric storms. As horrific a death world as any of its class in the Imperium. It is home to dense jungles, steamy swamps, magma geysers, volcanic eruptions, and sharp tectonic shifts. Vast, dangerous predators prowl, scuttle, slither, and stomp over its surface. Some are insectoids with sharpened proboscises that can pierce power armor, while others are reptilian hunters, as big as scout titans, that can crush battle tanks. Most crucially for the Flesh Terrors is the planet's extremely hardy human population, which has somehow adapted to survive in this most hostile of environments. The native Cretaceans rarely reject gene seed implants, and their deadly homeworld has made them rugged and daring, perfect for space marine recruitment. The Flesh Terrors have not used the process of insanguination for millennia, and few know whether this has caused the flaw's wide presence in the chapter, or has prevented a terrible situation from being even worse. Regardless, the chapter's gene seed has an abnormal mutation that renders Flesh Terrors much more vulnerable to the flaw than other sons of Sanguinius. Despite the suitability of their recruits, the chapter's significant battle casualties and genetic defects meant that, until the Ultima founding, the Flesh Terrors were woefully understrength. A dedicated assault force, the chapter are defined by their incredible savagery. They charge headlong into the fray, determined to rip apart their enemies wherever they find them. This recklessness has resulted in a high casualty rate, and much gene seed has been irretrievably lost as warriors have stormed into formidable defenses where their bodies cannot be safely recovered, or enemy fire so intense they have been reduced to atoms. The Flesh Terrors rarely work with allies. Their unrelenting brutality has left them shunned and distrusted by much of the rest of the Imperium, and many Inquisitors have sought to have the chapter investigated for its actions. This is not without cause. Forces that have found themselves between the Flesh Terrors and their enemies have later been discovered dead, reduced to chunks of hewn meat bearing the telltale marks of chainsword teeth. Though Chapter Master Gabriel Seth has done much to undo this reputation, it has not been one easily shed. A nominally Codex chapter, the Flesh Terror's organizational doctrine has differed to account for their low numbers and relatively small quantity of armored fighting vehicles and battle tanks. By the time of the devastation of Baal, their numbers were barely a third of Codex strength, and by battle's end they had suffered hideous casualties, reducing them no more than a standard company at best. Unlike most other Blood Angels successor chapters, the Flesh Terror's Death Company is a standing force, and none know how many make up its numbers. On more than one occasion, Gabriel Seth has even prevented Astaroth the Grim from conducting his bloody work when the Redeemer of the Lost has come to them. Between battles, many of the chapter's Death Company dwell in the Tower of the Lost on Cretacea, or on Death's Cow, a strike cruiser commanded by Chaplain Zufaz. It has been heavily converted to deploy the Death Company. Gabriel Seth. Wrathful, dour, and savage, Gabriel Seth is distrusted even by many of the Sanguinary Brotherhood's other chapter masters. Nonetheless, he has risen above both the Red Thirst and the Black Rage to demonstrate a sense of honor, loyalty, and duty that is truly in the image of Sanguinius. On the day of his ascension, Gabriel Seth listened, grim-faced, as the chapter's sanguinary priests presented evidence of the terrible truth. The rate at which their warriors succumbed to madness or death far exceeded the flesh terror's capacity to replace their losses. When Seth learned of this, he swore that if their fate was to be extinction, they would pass into history in proud remembrance, not in whispered rumors of brutality, madness. Under Seth's leadership, the Flesh Terror's chapter planet of Cretacea became little more than an automated armory and recruitment center. At any given time, before the devastation of Baal, the bulk of the Flesh Terrors were off-planet, performing great patrol arcs through the Segmentum's Ultima and Tempestus, while their librarians sifted through the aether in search of astropathic calls for assistance. So it was that the Flesh Terrors were often among the first wave of reinforcements to an embattled world. Seth himself led boarding actions against enemy blockade vessels, or counter-assaults on invaders' drop zones before the foe could claim so much as a foothold. Seth knows that he cannot realistically curtail his battle brother's bloodlust. He himself is as prone to rage-soaked savagery as any of his brethren. Yet by striking first, and in isolation from other forces, the worst excesses that were once the hallmark of the chapter's assaults can be concealed. Now, worlds that might once have reviled the Flesh Terrors praised them as saviors. Though Seth's plans have not worked in every war. Sometimes, despite the chapter master's best efforts, his battle brothers have overstepped the mark in brutal fashion. Such events culminated at Gaius Point during the Third War for Armageddon, where the Flesh Terrors slaughtered the defense militia and the Adeptus Auroritas of the Order of the Argent Shroud barely escaped with their lives. They reported the events to the Ordo Hereticus, and Seth was brought to trial on Baal, where he stood in the Forum Judicium of the Arx Angelicum, before a council of Sanguinary Brotherhood chapter masters. The gathering listed the Flesh Terror's crimes, recounting events on Stormark, Honor's End, and Lucid Prime, and the capture and breaking of Inquisitor Corvin Harold. Seth insisted that if any Flesh Terror was to be held accountable, it would be only him, and that his chapter would continue to serve the Imperium. It was only by the intervention of Astaroth the Grim the Flesh Terrors were not dissolved and Seth incarcerated on Baal indefinitely. The High Chaplain argued that the Flesh Terrors' terrible rage was needed to fight the horrific enemies of mankind. Not all of Seth's brothers have agreed with his methods. During the ferocious fighting on Baal Primus, alongside the Knights of Blood, Seth nearly came to blows with one of his chaplains. Chaplain Apollos believed that Seth cared more for the lives of other blood angels than his flesh terrors, sacrificing too many of his own brothers for Dante's chapter. Seth understands that, though his warriors often desire little more than to reach the enemy and rip them limb from limb, achieving victory requires more than butchery. Even as the forces of High Fleet Leviathan threaten to drown the Baal system in a never-ending deluge of chitinous creatures, Seth developed strategies to bleed the Xenos as much as possible. He had the strength of will and the authority to order warriors, desperate to hack apart Tyranids in bloody melee, to man-fixed defenses, He ordered for battle tanks to be chained into position to prevent their aggressive machine spirits from driving the vehicles headlong into the fray, alongside the chapter's battle brothers. Despite protestations, he was adamant that they kill only at the right time. It was this tactical awareness that allowed Seth to salvage a degree of his chapter's reputation in the eyes of the Imperium and the Sanguinary Brotherhood. And he continues to fight in this manner. In battle, he allows his warriors to indulge their bloodthirsty whims to the point that it is beneficial to his strategies, reining them in only when it is necessary, even if he himself is desperate to spill blood. He stresses decisive aggression in all things, except when restraint will yield the greater victory. With his chapter's Primaris reinforcements, Seth makes great use of assault intercessors and impulsor transports, supported by interceptors plummeting into battle from above to slaughter foes at close quarters. Blade Guard veterans anchor his line, the resolute warriors bedecked with relics that remind their brothers they are heirs to beauty as well as Red Fury. For all his efforts to challenge the commonly held perceptions of his chapter as berserk butchers, Gabriel Seth is every bit the bloody whirlwind in battle. He wields an enormous two-handed chainsword named Blood Reaver, and is more than capable of hacking even the most monstrous enemies limb from limb. As he fights, Seth lashes out at his opponents with vicious kicks, punches, and headbutts, using every part of his anatomy as a weapon. The chapter master prefers to plunge headlong into masked foes before unleashing his full ferocity upon the bodies pressed in around him. And it has been remarked by Commander Dante that such luckless victims would have had more chance of surviving a battle cannon shell landing in their midst. Indeed, the blood-drenched results are not dissimilar.